I think we should sing, Now Sophia, dream your vision, share the wisdom dwelling deep within. Now Sophia, dream your vision, share the wisdom dwelling deep within. Now Sophia, dream the vision, share the wisdom dwelling deep within.
Thank you. The way we will proceed this afternoon, each of our presenters will speak for about a half hour. And they have asked me to give them a sign so that they keep to that time. And after that, we will have a time for questions from the audience. We will be passing out note cards, if we get the note cards, for you to write those questions on. And people will be going up and down the aisles, probably between the speakers, to collect your questions so that we can read them up here afterward and all of you can hear. Questions? My name, by the way, is Pamela Carter-Jorn. Our first presenter today is Nalini Jayasuriya. Nalini is a painter, a writer, and a musician, and she told me that the only class that she was ever put out of was an art class. This happened to her when she was 8 or 9 years old. She said the teacher put objects around the room, triangles and squares and cubes and various things, and they were asked to draw them, and she simply could not do it. She tried so many times and erased her efforts so many times that she made a hole in the paper. And the teacher accused her of making the hole on purpose and told her she had to sit in the hall. While she was sitting in the hall, the principal came by. And interestingly enough, the principal was the sister of the art teacher. And Nalini said the principal really liked her. So the principal said, Nalini, what is the matter? And Nalini explained what had happened. Then the principal said, after this, when you are asked to do art, you have my permission to go to the library. And Nalini said she went with a glad heart. We welcome her today. I'm sure she has many things to tell us and share with us about her work. Nalini Jayasuriya.
I'm very honored to be here.
Will you speak here so we can hear
you? Yes, I'm very honored and very glad to be here this afternoon, and very grateful for the opportunity of being able to share some thoughts I have about what my life has been as a painter and as a musician and as a writer. So I thank Sally Hill, who invited me to this. It was a great surprise. I was up to three weeks ago at Yale University, which is my university, where I also had the privilege of teaching in the religion and arts program. And I was just at home for 3 weeks, and when I had this invitation, of course I came, because I've never had an experience like this, and since it's a once-in-a-lifetime event, no doubt, I was very glad to come. In my country, we have one form of greeting for every occasion and for every time of day. We put our hands together in a gesture of respect and say Ayubovan, which means may you live long. So I say Ayubovan to you now, to all of you, and this is my wish for all of you here and for all the people of this great country. This is a country that has done wonderful things for me. I have been here at Yale for about 7 years, and for 3 years with the Presbyterians, and perhaps a year doing all kinds of odd things in odd places. But the opportunities I was given at Yale, and all of these were financed and helped along for many years since I came in 1979 by the United Board for Christian Higher Education. So I owe many people in this great country a very, very deep debt of gratitude for opportunities given to me to do the things that I wanted to do, not just the things that I had to do. And I was delighted to come here and find many of my old friends from Louisville and from elsewhere, particularly Mary Ann Lundy, who was a wonderful support and help to me in Louisville, a beloved friend, Carol Davies, who I think along with me looked at every flea market around Louisville. We had great times together. And there are many, many other wonderful people who are here at this time, and I'm grateful for the opportunity of being able to see them. There, at Yale, one of the greatest influences of my life was that of Professor John Wesley Cook, who some of you may have heard of as the person who began the Religion and Arts program. And this is where I graduated, and I also, as I said before, had the opportunity of teaching in. I taught there a course on the art and architecture of Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity, and Islam, in that historical order. And I've done that in many, many countries of the world, in Denmark and in Switzerland, at the universities in Copenhagen and Geneva, and in many countries in Asia, as Elizabeth Luce Moore Professor. And this was a very great honor to be to have this. It is a professorship that has been set up in honor of one of the most distinguished American women, Elizabeth Luce Moore, belongs to the Luce, famous Luce family. And the Luce family has been very significant in my life. The Presbyterian, to have been with the Presbyterians was a very special gift to me. I'm neither American nor Presbyterian. I belong to the Anglican Church. And it was all initiated by one of the most remarkable women I have ever known, Dr. Aurelia Fuller. And there I met one kindness after another. Those were perhaps three of the happiest years of my life. So I would like to say again how wonderful it has been to be in this great country for now almost 10 years, if I add all the years up, to have had many opportunities, which I've also had in other countries, but in different ways. So I'm deeply grateful for these opportunities to do again what I want to do. There is a Taoist saying, the Tao, as you may, some of you may know, is a very great source, ancient source of ancient Chinese wisdom. And one of the things they say is that those who talk do not know, and those who know do not talk. Notwithstanding, I'm going to try to say some some of the things that I wish to share with you today. We talk about the imagination, we talk about reimagining, we talk about the religious imagination, and sometimes we're not quite sure what all this means. As a somewhat creative person, I am the child of two very creative parents. My mother was a good musician and a painter who was able to paint what she saw. I do quite a different thing. And my father was a musician, not a very high order, but he could play everything he heard. And I can do the same, but I studied music. So the imagination, which has in many ways not such a good connotation in the minds of some people, because it's always mixed up with what is known as fantasy. There's a great difference between the imagination and fantasy. The fantasy is something that creates all kinds of ideas and forms and things that may not have any very great value. There's nothing wrong in it, but they are not of any great value. But the imagination, particularly the religious imagination, is that which has created some of the most wonderful, wonderful visual and other forms that one sees throughout the world. And on the 17th of September, I did a lecture at Yale, and I called it, I Believe. If you consider that, you realize that all the most wonderful buildings and other forms that have been created by human beings, be it music, be it the dance form, be it any of the visual arts, anything in sound, movement, all these have been the result of the life and work of people who have been able to believe. You see the wonderful Gothic churches of the Western world. You see the extraordinary sacred spaces of Asia. Some of the most wondrous buildings of the world have been built as a result of those people who believed. So this is very, very important for us to remember that the religious imagination has created not only things of wonder, but things that have lasted for thousands of years. We have buildings, Buddhist and Hindu, and much later, of course, Islamic buildings, and everything that goes with them in our part of the world, in Asia and the Far East. And these are there as witness, as confession, and as affirmation of faith. This is what has happened when people have been able to believe. And the religious imagination is something quite different to what is known as the ordinary imagination of people, because this is something that exalts one, that carries one far beyond what is seen and known. One of the most wonderful and extraordinary stories for me since I was a very small child has been the story of the three kings, or the kings, in the New Testament. Here are a couple of people who really know nothing. They don't know what they really want. They don't know where they are going. But they find in themselves a necessity to find something beyond what they know. So they set out on a journey. Now it doesn't matter if this is a pure myth, it's not true at all. What is important is the significance of this in the lives of many people. Here are these three people who set out on a journey, and they follow that most unlikely guide of all, a star. They follow it. And we don't know how many countries they went through, whether they really went or whether it was in their imagination, we don't know. But they made this journey following a star, a guiding light that took them finally to the place where Christ was born. They arrived, making this journey, they arrived at the source of all truth. So this has been for me an extraordinary and wonderful, wonderfully, an endlessly wonderful story. It's a story that fills me with wonder every time I read it, and I have read it a million times. And I see it in a whole lot of different ways, because it is a quest that we all either have made or must make, a quest for knowledge beyond the knowledge we already have. And this is the journey of the spirit. It is what one would call a search for the miraculous. I paint this in a variety of ways. And every time I paint it, it looks different. But the energy within it is the same. It is the need to discover beyond what we already know. In Asia, this is something that is very natural to people. In Hinduism, the search is on forever. You search for renewal. You imagine and reimagine. And here at this conference, this is what all of us have been trying to do. Another wonderful story, a picture that I have from the Bible, I think is very suitable to talk about here at this conference. It is a meeting of Mary and Elizabeth. I've often wondered as a child, what do these women talk about? Here's Mary who goes running to another woman who sits before her, and I painted this. She sits before her and she tells her what the angel has told her. And I've often wondered what Elizabeth said to her in return. Wondered what this conversation was about, because it was no ordinary conversation. And what is wonderful, the most wonderful of all, was when Mary says, "My soul magnifies the Lord." Here is the fullest extent of reimagining a situation that she was in, an extent of the imagination, an extent of this spirit within her that had perhaps not even come to terms with this wondrous event that she'd been told about. So those are two stories which have affected me very, very deeply in my life, amongst many others. The one of the things that a lot of people in the West, I think, do not see too much importance in is a religious image. In Asia, it is something that is synonymous with all religious practice. But I quite understand the reason for this and the need for the Reformation, because the image was abused. The use of it was in many ways not put to the best, in the best ways, not used in the best ways. But in Asia, people use images not as religious and sacred in themselves, but for what they are able to do for you. So the image in itself is something that helps you to recollect. In some ways, it helps you to focus your attention, perhaps. It has a variety of uses, but the main reason for having an image is to recall the absent person. As I said, it is not sacred in itself. So in Hinduism, you find many of these images, once their usefulness is over, that they have served a purpose in worship in the temple, they throw the image away. See, so it has, they have not been used in the same way in which the image was used in the West before the Reformation. Now, what I find often, in some ways, very disappointing, is that people don't realize the power of the image. See, the moment I mention a name of a person in history or of anything, you see this. Do you see this as a word, or do you see it as an image? See, all of our lives, all of it is full of images. We think in images. We speak in images. All of our focus is around and from images. So images have a very special power that one cannot deny. And there, this is the place of the artist, the creative person, the painter, the musician, the writer, the dancer, the architect, the sculptor, and all those who are affected and directed and influenced and inspired by these images. So it is very, very important to recognize not only the power of the image, but its value in the life of worship. We do, to a very great extent, in our part of the world. One of the important things about this conversation between Mary and Elizabeth, as I think always think about it and around it, is that when these two women sit together, they form a circle. And the circle is the prime symbol of Asia. The circle has neither beginning nor end. It's ceaselessly renewing within itself. And you find that the circle is the basis of a great deal of the religious thought in Asia. All of the belief in transmigration, in rebirth, is centered in the circle. See, and this is quite obvious as one watches nature. It is always not the departure, but the return that is important. One sees this in one's garden. One sees this in the life around ourselves. We see this. I live on one of the most beautiful seashores of the world. from my upstairs lounge, I can see the sea and I hear the sea throughout the night. This is what I miss most when I'm abroad. And this eternal return of the wave back to the sea. It's not, what is important to me is not the wave comes up to the shore, but that the wave returns. And as you return, you are renewed. As you imagine, you're able to reimagine. And this is something that comes when one's life is centered in belief, in faith, whatever that faith may be. And this, again, is something that I would like to mention to you. I'm Christian. As I said, I come of a third-generation Christian family. On my mother's side, it's one of the strongest and most powerful Buddhist families of the South. But my mother became a Christian at the age of 7 because she liked the parables that were told her in her school by her English chaplain. And I always told my mother that she must be a very spoiled child to have gone up to her father, who was a strong Buddhist, and said she wanted to become a Christian. Well, she became a Christian. She was a Methodist to begin with, but my father belonged to the Anglican Church, and when they got married later on, she became an Anglican. And we were brought up in a very rigorous Christian household. We went to church and went to Sunday school. I played the organ throughout most of my life when I lived in Sri Lanka. And we were very much bound in the life of the church. But I see these great differences. And it is not that one is better than the other. But in Asia, people go to worship because they want to. And they do this every day. It is spontaneous. It is individual. Asian religions are not congregational. The only one that is, to a certain extent, is Islam, where people gathered, men, only men, get together to pray. Women, of course, pray at home. And both Buddhists and Hindus go to the temple every day, and they carry white flowers or some flowers to remind them of the dying body. They take oil to feed the lamps, which help them to remember that knowledge is eternal, and therefore life is eternal. So there's great significance in the life of worship amongst Asians. There's not only great significance, there's a depth of faithfulness, a depth of sincere belief that is very, very difficult, perhaps, to compare with other religions in other places. I would like to say just a few words about what my work has been. I have been for years and years a teacher. I have taught at several universities and schools, high schools, and at universities. During my time with the Presbyterians, I taught in several places in this country, just did lectures all over, always wonderfully received with the most wonderful wonderful support and enthusiasm. At the moment, I have this research fellowship and grant at Yale and United Board for Christian Higher Education to write this book on the four major religions of Asia. But this is not going to be, I hope, a dull theological essay on these four religions, because lots of people, not in a dull way, they have done superbly in their own way. But what I'm trying to do here is to bring a new emphasis into this, a new dimension into this. So I shall be trying to talk about the art and architecture that have resulted from the life of faith in these four religions. So for instance, I shall try to tell people about why each sacred space has a particular form and serves a particular set of liturgical purposes. And the main reason for doing this is because I have been fascinated by the differences. In one town in my country, you see these four different types of architecture. I'm very interested in sacred space, in sacred architecture, because that is the beginning of a religious consciousness that makes you build something that suits your own brand of belief. So the Gothic spires ascend to heaven. It's an architecture of ascent, a verticality that reaches up to the heavens. the Hindu is totally different. It incorporates all of the energies of nature. So it is in some way earthbound and in some way rises. It is based on the mountain as the center of the earth, Mount Meru, the center of the earth. Wherever a Hindu temple is built, they believe that is the center. The mosque is very different. I've seen all the great mosques, old mosques of the whole world. I haven't seen the ones in the Middle East because they are new. I'm not interested. Some of the most beautiful buildings in the world of sacred space are in Iran. And I hope some of you will have the opportunity to see them. They are out of this world. Now the Buddhist is very different. They are fairy-like. They look as if they are going to float. There's something so delicate and beautiful about Islamic architecture. You see many examples, of course, in Turkey, in Pakistan, in India, in Indonesia, in certain countries in the Far East, some of them, and most of all, of course, in Iran and in Turkey. And then, of course, the Buddhist is very different. It immediately exemplifies points of this faith. It is in the shape and the style of a burial mound, because the essential teaching of Buddhism is that everything changes, based on the word anicca, A-N-I-C-C-A, which means change, impermanence. So you're constantly reminded of this when you see the Buddhist architecture, which is in the shape of a burial mound. So each one of these has its own fascination. Now, I would like, not because she nudged me, but because I have to end, I'd like to tell you a story which has very deep meaning for me. It's my story. But before I do that, I would like to say that the Bible has not only a marvelous a whole history of revelation, of prophecy, of truth expressed in a variety of ways, but it is the book that contains perhaps the most number of instances of the religious imagination. You see these people of prophecy. That is in one's religious imagination. They are able to speak as they do, and see as they do, and do as they do. I'd like to tell you this very short little story. It's about an old man and his grandson. The old man teaches the little grandson about God and about all the works of God. And the little boy is very confused about all this. So one day he asks his grandfather, "Who is God? You're always talking about God. Who is he? Is he a man?" And grandfather says, "Yes." He said, "Is it a woman?" Grandfather says, "Yes." And he looks round and there's a deer running through the forest, and he said, "Is it a deer?" Grandfather says, "Yes." There's a bird suddenly in the trees. He said, "Is it a bird?" He says, "Yes." And then there suddenly the little boy hears the water in the stream, and he says, "Is God the water?" Grandfather says, "Yes." And then the wind, he says, is God the wind?" Grandfather says, "Yes." The little boy says to the old man, he said, "Grandfather, you say God is everything." And he said, "Yes, God is everything." And that was what God is. The boy is not very satisfied. He can't understand it all. So he says, grandfather says to him, "Now go and pick up this seed. There's a seed from a fruit of the tree under which they are sitting. And this little fruit," he says, "now take the skin off." The boy does it, and there's another skin underneath. And he says, "Now peel that one off." And he goes on peeling and peeling and peeling and peeling the skins till he comes to the final tiny little kernel. And then he opens the kernel. He says, "There's nothing." So he said, "Yes. Can you believe that this tree from which this fruit came from nothing?" He says, "No, I don't think so." He says, "Yes, that is God. God is there. He exists in our imagination. The truth of it is that God is there. We do not see him. We do not hear him. We do not know anything about him, but we know he is there." Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Our next speaker will be Nancy Chin, whom you've already met through her great banners that are hanging in the ballroom and the painting that she's doing on the stage. Yes, and the work that we are doing at our own tables that she has instructed us to do. Before I introduce Nancy with her story, we need to have the use of a small...
I've got it. I didn't realize the podium's got one.
All right, okay. Never mind. I bet you wonder what that was. A small pin.
This is the end of side one.
Nancy told me that she would like to thank her children for encouraging her to begin painting. When her children were 1, 2, and 4 years old, they lived on an Indian reservation in Oregon. She would take her children into the living room and show them a timer. She set the timer for 1 hour, and she would say to her children, "Now you will see me, but you cannot talk to me during this hour." And she would set up her work and put on headphones with lots of loud music and paint furiously for 1 hour. She said she knew this was good for her children because when she got done, she was a nicer person. Then when the paintings were finished, she put them up on the mantle, and the children were the first critics. The one that was in a playpen at that time is now an artist, and all three of them are creative, artistic people. So that was a good model and a good lesson and a good help to Nancy.
I've never used one of these. That's quite like this. It's a remote, and I'm used to being all wired up with all these things you have to push. I need to know who you are. How many of you are artists? Oh, yes. How many of you are musicians? Great. Dancers. Pastors. Lay people. Other artists. Now, why isn't everybody's hand up? How many of you are artists? Yes. I'm a working class woman. You're going to hear this from quite a different perspective. I've also written out my script because I want to be very clear with you about what I'm going to be talking about. I want to try to address three areas of interest today. They are the symbol system. I want to challenge our imagination about what that might be. I want us to think about new ways of being an artist, new ways for the church to imagine art, I see that as one section, and new images of old religious ideas, new holy cards, as it were. There are two women I especially want to thank today. One is not here, the Reverend Gail Morris, and one is here, Dr. Estella Lauder, who have helped me form these ideas, and all the other countless women, many of you are in this room, who've helped me and nurtured me along this very interesting path. Because my style of work just doesn't happen in isolation. I'm not one of those artists who goes up into the garret, you know, and comes out with something. I need your energy, and I need to be able to give it back to you. So I cultivate all the skills I can find of dialogue. I hate talking like this. I wish we could talk together. And relationship. Because that's what moves me toward where I need to go. There are others who are not as extroverted as I, who work differently, but that's the way I work. Now I'd like to talk about symbols. Throughout our tradition, there's been a long history of Christian symbols that have been used to convey our doctrine. Sometimes we do this in narrative art, and sometimes like the group of 10 that you may have found up in Lounge A. Those are narrative art that I did about stories of women and abuse shared with our biblical sisters and us today. Thank you. I hope that you go see it. It's scary work. But sometimes this is done through a complex system of signs that symbolize and contain a coded message. Now write an alpha and omega, or if you haven't got a pen out, have somebody near you write it and look at it. Omegas look like a horseshoe. The system works this way. If you memorize the code, you can shortcut the memory to an idea. You see, we work toward our head with this system. It's like a computer. You know, if you've got a computer, you push a certain button and you get this certain thing to happen. The symbol system works like that. For instance, now look at it. What do you remember about that? Do you remember where it came from? Do you remember when you learned it? Do you remember what its connection is with anything of your own personal life? Do you remember where it is in the Bible? Why it's there? You probably have some connection with that symbol. But I have a problem with that. It relies on your intellect. And as an artist, I want to rely on your heart. I want to begin here, not here. I also have a problem with it because it comes out of a Western European base, from an era that is not my own. And I want more. I want more from my art. You might even read elite there. You've got to know the system to be able to understand the image. I want something that anyone can understand. And so we'll look at modern art. The church hasn't really looked very hard at modern art. The church is uncomfortable with it. And I'll be addressing a little bit later in this talk why that is. Why we have not yet been able to seriously embrace that. But it's because the modern art really relies on metaphor, and it requires many different points of view to interpret it. Now let's see if all this system works. We're going to go down lights and up lights. Here I find the most powerful use of art, if it's going to come on. This is a Pentecost piece from Grace Cathedral. I'm going to walk you through it. Here the art is used to evoke, to help the soul dance between mood and idea, between theology and spirit. This piece is 200 feet long, 60-something feet high, 60-something feet wide, I can't remember anymore, painted nylon net. Everything I do is temporary because I want to give space for new creativity, new images, new ways of understanding who God is right now. This is from the celibate's point of view. Here, art, it also can work like a stage design, like a mask for the architecture. This is a tree of life that was put up the day before the Gulf War at Grace Cathedral. I'll walk you through it. It's paper lace. This is the top of it. The sun, the moon and stars, the weather, the roots. And with my Jewish friends, I have many conversations about what was on that tree of knowledge. And my friend Joe got half of the tree and I got half the tree. Half of its apples and half of its figs. So that's a fig apple tree. And of course it comes out of water. All out of the water of chaos. And it dwelled in its beauty above the baptismal font and greeted people as they came in. And because of its size, it billowed in the space and contained breath. Lights. How does liturgical art differ then than regular art? I think it has to do with context. I have abandoned the symbol system of the church that I spoke of earlier, and it's the formal elements of modern art that are my focus and the potential for me for using the metaphors that I do in church. In the following slides, I'm going to illustrate from my own work what I mean visually. However, I can't really tell you what that is. You have to be there. Because it's not just about the visual information, it's about the whole service that goes on at the same time. So,
Sorry, that was a little bit brief. Wynn, let's go back down. I'm going to give you just one illustration of each idea. Light and dark. And these come straight out of nature. This is an old piece. Some of you may have seen this. This is from a Presbyterian church that does not know anything about or did not know anything about Easter Vigil. So this had been a piece that they'd had for Lent. It covered up a stained glass window but hinted that there was something beyond it. The sculpture's focus? Let's see. Focus. If there's somebody near the projector who could focus, that would be great. Can't. Well, not quite. If there's somebody who knows how to work a projector, would you please work the focus on it? I suspect it's an autofocus and it's going to keep going doing that. So anyway, they had this for Lent that covered up the front huge architectural cross that was there. When they came in on Easter, it looked like this. It was very dark. The lights weren't on. The music was not playing. The candles weren't lit. There were these weird shapes there, and the curtain was there, but not the crown of thorns. The service began with someone singing quietly from the balcony, "Were You There?" the old spiritual. And then the reading for the day was read, which was, "Why are you seeking the living among the dead? He is not here. He has risen." And the choir sang those words with trumpet. And at the same time, the curtain dropped. Just this was in place. And then the organ began, the introduction to "Christ the Lord is risen today." And all these things happened at once that I'm going to just go with right now. Somebody really does need to focus these. Stand there and work the focus knob. All the pulpit cloths were changed from Lent to Easter. The vestments that people had were changed. All that color came up from behind those shapes. It looked like this, and at the same time people came in carrying baskets of colored flowers, lit all the candles. It took the 45 seconds of the introduction of the hymn, and the people rose and sang, "Christ the Lord is risen today." That's the use of light and dark. As the people turned to leave, this was in place. The next thing I'd like to talk about is transparency and opacity. These are tools I use. They're not really symbols. They're formal art elements. This is just the light coming through the window transparently across a pew. Transparency and opacity. And this actually is the first piece I ever did. We had in our church adopted two Ethiopian refugees. This is Ethiopian imagery. What I didn't have a clue about when I began this was that they were sheer and that they would move when the people moved. And as they moved, they'd appear and disappear in the light. Weird. I made up little stories about these angels. You know, this is you in the center. And all those blessings that surround you are so many you can't even count them. I hate to tell you this, but they have been lost. Scale. You know, we simply don't make it big enough. How can you talk about God in 3 feet by 5 feet in a church that's got a 40-foot ceiling? It's just got to be big. So this is an Advent piece from the C cycle of the lectionary. By the way, I always start with the Bible. I discern with people, what is it you're trying to get across? And I'll elaborate on that later in this talk. This is the angel of fire. It comes from Jesus preaching about the end of the world, how awful it's going to be. The angel of water. You getting it? Fire, water. This is from John's baptizing. Notice the transparency, notice the color, it's all there, but we're talking about scale. Earth swinging between the moon and the stars and the sun and air. When Elizabeth and Mary met and the children were born, what's the first thing we do? We don't see first, we breathe. Until the host came and surrounded the people. Repetition, pattern. You know that old rosary? There was something there. Repeating it again and again and again. This image, which I do need focused, I'll take you through it. It's from It should focus more than that, but I've never seen it that out of focus. Thank you. These are origami cranes. There are about 25,000 of 50,000 that the Diocese of San Francisco folded in 1980. When did we have the earthquake? 1989. For the then 50,000 deaths of AIDS in people here in America, and every one of them had somebody's name on it. Oh, that was backwards. Focus. I don't know why this does this, but thank you. They were hung in a series of five curtains to create the image, with about 100 people working. You can see the curtains now, hung from the catwalk. And here's a close-up of what they look like. It's a repetition. Color. This is a real simple one. This is from Pentecost. And it's the Comforter coming. And it's simply ribbon blessing this space. Texture. And also in this one, oh, it's upside down. I'm sorry. Turn your head. This also will be about movement, which is the last one that I do. Some of you may have been at Ames at the Coliseum with a theme, Whose World Is It? It was all done with paper lace. We use the same image again and again. And this, as we talk about integrity of creation and the fact that we have covered it up with concrete and other abusive activities, the white paper lace was replaced by abused paper lace. And then there were themes of native stories of creation, and we had images like this, and then we tore it all up and we hung it as shreds when we talked about justice. Then the people began hearing stories that evening of hope, and we began filling the shards of broken paper with angels. Some of you may recognize that angel. And then all of the white creation pieces came back and joined the angels. The last evening was a cross. I personally have a great deal of trouble with the cross. I do not find it a salvific image at all. So I reclaimed it this way. Around the center were human faces. The top were images from the North Pole, the equator in the center, the South Pole at the bottom, and I could ask who or what is on that cross. And what does that mean? Does that mean that the earth has to be sacrificed for redemption to happen? Or does it mean redemption doesn't happen out there somewhere, but right here on earth? Okay, now I'd like to discuss, if we can have the lights on for just a minute. I've tried to give you a context to understand where I come from, and now I would like to talk and perhaps even to challenge some basic assumptions about what art and church might even be about. Now I'd like to discuss a wonderful project to give you a paradigm of how it can work. And in doing so, further try to explain some of these ideas while discussing new ways of being an artist and new ways to look theologically at art. The commission came from Gail Morris. She called up one day and said, I really want you to work with a church, but I haven't got the foggiest idea what I want you to do. Can you tell me what your interests might be? Says I, quick to spot a soapbox. Oh, yes, I'm very interested in relationships. I would like to explore some of those ideas theologically and artistically. And back and forth our ideas went. And we decided that we would begin with an in-house retreat using art materials as a place to explore relationships as content and process for the next 10 weeks. The cathedral here in Minneapolis explored the whole question of relationship with liturgy, education, and programmed events. During the second week, the people were invited and given a very sheer piece of fabric about 9 inches wide, about 6 feet long, and were asked to pick a particular relationship during the period of time in the church that they were working on relationships, pick a particular relationship and pray about it. And then just like we have scribbles, you know, on our tables that are almost like artifacts of what we've been thinking about, they were asked to use that scrap of fabric as an artifact of that prayer. So people brought them back the ninth week of this project, filled with paint and stitches and lunch. And one person ran it through their computer, and another person used Xerox images on it. I mean, everybody brought back their own prayer strip. Then we rolled them. I came back, and we rolled them together as a canopy over the people, through the cathedral that went from the back to the front. Then the miracle happened. Under this beautiful, wispy canopy of the prayers of the people, the following liturgy was held. You know, in the Episcopal tradition, lights. In the Episcopal tradition, they have a wonderful program of lessons and carols. So the staff put together a liturgy of lessons and carols about relationships. It happened on Mother's Day, 1993. The reader that I would like to share with you was a woman of about 80, whose white hair barely reached above the podium, and who walked with two canes, and who read the following. This is as you come into the cathedral. There are seven slides of this, and I'll just flip through them. My children are coming today. They mean well, but they worry. They think I should have a railing in the hall, a telephone in the kitchen. They want someone to come in when I take a bath. They really don't like my living alone. Help me to be grateful for their concern and help them to understand that I have to do what I have to do as long as I can. They're right when they say there are risks. I might fall. I might leave the stove on. But there is no challenge, no possibility of triumph, no real aliveness without risk. Could you monitor that for me and just keep? Thank you. When they were young and climbed trees and rode bicycles and went away to camp, I was terrified. But I let them go because to hold them would have been to hurt them. Now our roles are reversed, help them see. Keep me from being grim and stubborn about it. But don't let them smother me. I have been young and now I am old. I found that to be the gospel. Now I'd like the lights again. I'd like to quote to you from two letters that would best say what needs to be said here about the role of the artist in the church. I cannot get over what a gift you gave to this place. It was so wonderful to have us all so focused and so in tune with each other. The Holy Spirit does indeed run through you and work through you, and I'm so grateful to have been in the fallout. Since the festival, I've had some time to think and reflect on those parts which were most meaningful to me and how grateful I am for your being here and your participation, your gifts of creativity. The whole festival was marked by relationships beyond any that I could have imagined was possible to demonstrate. I believe that the life of the cathedral parish has been altered by your efforts and participation in Festival Week. So not enough for me to be a good designer. I think the role of the artist in the church might have a further dimension. I'm going to skip this part because we're running short of time. I want you to see the last images. Ask me questions about it later, so we can be subversive. But I want to just briefly say, and I'll clue you in, that I think that the role of the art for the church is to teach people how to be in relationship by teaching them how to see and how to listen and keep quiet. And enter a relationship with the work itself. I think you can practice that with this work, and I have my slides clued up about the work up here, but I'm going to skip this part. I'll come back to it if appropriate. I would like you to practice listening now with the other carousel. And so would you please trade it? About 5 years ago, I heard a lecture by Dr. Estella Lauder, and I woke up about 2 weeks before this talk preparing for it and remembered that slide lecture, I called her, and in the way that Sophia works, I got her on the only hour she was in her office. It gets better. She came to another conference here in Minneapolis at the Hyatt at the same time that we were here and gave me the slides. So thank you very, very much. About 5 years ago when I saw the work, I realized in looking at it that contemporary artists are dealing with much of the same issue that we are here in the church. And contemporary theologians and contemporary artists are not talking to each other. And I thought today might be the good day to start building that bridge. I'd like to propose that these women that I'm going to discuss and the artists like them might lead us toward a new kind of holy image, one that might stand beside, or dare I hope replace, some of our more traditional images. Try it out for yourself as we see these slides and hear the words that Estella brought to us that day, which I will paraphrase and bring to you today. This is from Maria Akeeler. Will you correct me, Estella?
Akeeler,
thank you. It is from a series of reliefs called Love to Death. It's painted on aluminum like an outsider artist might paint. Notice that the sculptural elements can't stay contained in that space. They have to flee out. Here we have an image of paradise that does not look very safe. The self-portrait is that white deer in the center. That's her in the center, and she's being overcome by a stronger animal in a ritual that is sanctioned by that candelabra in the lower part. At the apex of a pyramid of light, her winged spirit flies away. The title of this piece is Loved to Death, The Embrace. Like Lilith, as she flies out of the apex, she would rather flee paradise than be pinned down. Maria's words, paradise was never an idyllic place, particularly for women. Her series might stand for the condition of many women in cultures where love is synonymous with possession. The result is death, regardless of the motive. In This Message Will Not Be Repeated by Ellen Kiefer or Kiefer, we have an interesting revisiting of this ancient goddess who governs so much of our image of who we are as women. But what has Kiefer done? Here, the woman and the pedestal that she's on are bound up. The title is This Message Will Not Be Repeated. It is an image of active protest. And together with her title, it asserts refusal to continue to worship the image of woman given to us in our culture as a starting place for us to redefine who we are as women. We can bind up the old images or we can simply let go of them. In Sisyphus Unbound, Ethel Schwabacher gives us a vision of what it might be to move on. Remember the story, how he pushed the rock up the hill? Well, in this image, he doesn't push it up anymore. He simply lets go and bounds down the hill. Where is he bounding to? What is this new life? What would it mean to let go of our rock of patriarchy and simply construct a new way to be? In Past Meet Present, we have one of two ways of dealing with this. As a woman who is in a minority in our church, I really identify with this piece. My experience as a lesbian is I cannot belong. And this piece says that so clearly to me. We have to find new ways to build bridges, because this is the reality many of us live in now. In Caught Between Night Suns, we see reconciliation in a different way. Here she has portrayed herself both as self and artist. Both are naked, both vulnerable, both are very clear. Notice where her brush is placed on the life line of the hand. Notice that she sits in a sign of womanhood, a pool of menstrual blood, and both in solidarity look toward the viewer. In this work, I find her asking if reconciliation is an internal process rather than one that we can incorporate the values of the world outside. In this image, which is called Prima Para, and I'm sorry I have to go fast, I just got my nudge. This is an image of birth, where the artist felt her power both as pregnant one and erotic one, and was claiming her animal and human nature. This is the top piece, a detail of it. In Medusa Face, one knows another in our tradition by a name. The artist is suggesting we can, through our imagination, find the Medusa. Now, Medusa is a very interesting character. We don't have time to go into much of that. She's been demonized by our culture, by our faith, but in fact, it's about women's power. And those of us who've moved through therapeutic relationships, either professional or spiritual, from victim to power, have faced this Medusa and have found in her an icon of freedom to make our own choices. In a way, we have found the power of life over death. Here's another image of Medusa. Here she is restored to the healing role as the creator of the universe in an altarpiece, Great Medusa. Creation of the cosmos. Her headdress is made in the image of our reproductive system. Notice that her gaze is, notice the place of the planets as ovaries. Her hands are spread in benediction. Her gaze is that of an icon. The artist shared that the community tried to destroy this image when it was put up. We're still trying to get rid of Medusa.
This is the end of side two. The message is continued on the second tape.
This is called Small Black Eve. Notice the snake rises between her legs as an undulating system of knowledge. She's got many hands and many arms to carry on her work. There's no apology here, only strength. In Creation and Recreation, Suzanne Okamoto has a black mother in birth posture blowing human lives out of her mouth and taking them back through the top of her head in the space of the third eye. Another of her images is the vision of the creative force as embracing and nurturing feminine power in waters above and below the firmament. The snakes come back as a latent reminder of the knowledge of the emerging universe. And these are my favorite. I hope we get time for them. Judith Anderson, Missagaya, this is my body. The warp is made out of a living female body that was herself composed of infinite variety of creatures engaged in a vast exchange of lives. This is the body we take and eat. This mother is painfully aware of the loss. It is another kind of pietà. It contains, as the artist said, both creation and profound grief and anger. Another of her works, the mandala of the spinning goddess, is a very sexualized birthing image with a hooded clitoris. And what emerges is the thread of our lives. A crone midwives, but an ordinary woman weave the fabric of the lives with their own hands. I have to stop. Can I do this last one? This is it. In Spinster, she understands, Helen Klebsiedel understands that the thread is spun by a pregnant woman quickly, and that quickly becomes the net that stretches out to encompass the planets. Notice that the phases of the moon herself, rather than controlling our lives, are now part of our responsibility. Thank you.
We're just going to take a minute here while we're setting up the musical machine. It's a musical piano, I think, for our next presentation. You could, at this time, if you have any questions, write them on the card. Would you please put the name of the person to whom you would like your question addressed, if it matters to you? Maybe it's a general question for all three of our artists. And then we'll pick them up. You might want to stand and stretch for just a minute.
Is there somebody who plays the instrument?
Is there someone present?
Plays a hymn.
Who can be a pianist for us? Yes, would you come forward? I think we're about ready to go. If you'd please be seated. Our third presenter today is Ingelina Nielsen. Ingelina is a church musician and I think knowledgeable and accomplished in music all around the world. Some of you may have enjoyed singing with her in a late afternoon options yesterday. Ingelina gave me this story to read to you. 2.5 years ago, her husband and Ingelina were required to leave their home, their children, and all their belongings in Switzerland. She notes that everything was moved away in a container except for the children. They left for a new appointment in Africa, not in Asia, which had been their second home. They are now nationed in Zimbabwe. Throughout her life and in all the sermons that she listened to as a church musician, she was searching for a less oppressive image of God. Her first aha experience came from reading Rosemary Radford Ruther's book, Sexism and God Talk. Her second aha experience into more freedom came through Wesley Ariyaraja's friendship in Geneva. He was a colleague at the World Council of Churches from Sri Lanka. No human being or institution like the church is great enough to comprehend the full truth of God. Therefore, we Christians have to acknowledge God's self-disclosure in other religions. There is only one God. Instead of missionizing and confrontational attitudes, we need dialogue. Ingelina is not now an active organist or church musician. Since moving to Zimbabwe, she has studied the Mbira. Did I say that right?
Mbira,
which is a thumb piano, which I know nothing about, but would be interested in learning what that looks like, the drum, and kinesiology, which is also called touch for health. Ingelina Nielsen.
When I met Chung Yong Kyung the other day and we exchanged travel experiences, I was amazed that I think she comes from more miles away than I am, but made it in half the time I needed to reach you, 30 hours. I'm very, very happy to be here, and the 30 hours are forgotten. I was positioned, unfortunately, between two men in the plane, which was overloaded. One was a bishop, or looked like a bishop with his attire. The other one was a missionary, and there was no talk between us. I tried several times, but I thought, okay, this is typical. So I did not disclose why I was on this plane. Today, I want to share with you and go through you with, I will tell you the structure so you are aware what comes at the end, and I hope you are looking forward to it. God's image in music of different cultures is the title. We will start with ourselves, move to what we are experience in our churches and what we have exported as Christians to everybody else in the world. We will sing a song from a mission field, and we will analyze this and then come back to ourselves, because I think we all who are here have one testimony in common, and that is we are yearning for an image of God that is different than what we experience in our churches, or partially different from what we experience in our churches. So I would like you to stand up after the... please, yes. I want you to let everything go deep into yourself that we just experienced with Nancy and Nalini. It is a very rich experience that we need to let fall into our center. I want you to breathe deeply. Listen to yourselves. Find where your most secure place is, where you are yourself. Find silence there, or vibration, or music. It's the place where we and God are one. It's the place where music is in us. And that music is between you and God and His creation. Please take this connectedness with you through this session now. Thank you, and sit down. I would really invite you to fathom everything we do now against this background of being connected with yourself. What image of God do we worship in our music, in our churches, especially when we sing hymns? And what have we exported around the world? To answer this question, I chose Lift High the Cross, the hymn Lift High the Cross, which I hope many of you know. May I ask you to play it? I want you to listen now only to the melody and make up your mind, what does it suggest to you? What does music suggest, this music suggest to you?
I just vote for send for help. Just keep going.
Oh, I'm sorry. Do we have a piano?
It's not ready. Till the piano is ready, I think I use the time and read the text to it. I wanted to do it the other way because I want you to show how powerful music is, but I think for this reason I will do it the other way around. Lift high the cross, the love of Christ proclaim, till all the world adore his sacred name. That is the refrain. Come, brethren, follow where our captain trod, our King victorious, Christ, the Son of God. Led on their way by his triumphant sign, the hosts of God in conquering ranks combine, each newborn soldier of the crucified bears on his brow the seal of him to the of him who died. This is the sign which Satan's legions fear and angels veil their faces to revere. I stop here, I think it's enough.
But we can stay in the building?
Yes, it's
So please try to ignore the sound that we have in the background. Be stronger than it. Now, what about the text? Till all the world, to me, sounds like a threat coming not anymore from the first world or from the Christian surrounding. We, in this hymn, is brethren, is conquering ranks, is newborn soldiers with a sign of the cross on their eyebrows. I don't identify with this, I'm sorry. Captain, for me, is a military expression, is Jesus, is the King victorious. When I prepared this, I wondered, is there any place that Jesus refers to himself as the king? I don't know. And now comes the worst, I think, they. Who are they? The ones in the mission field? Satan's legions? From farthest regions? Let them homage bring? Is everything that is non-Christian evil? Okay, let me just, if many of you, can you come and sing with me? Lift high the cross, the love of Christ proclaim, till all the world adore his sacred name. It is a march. I mean, that is very obvious. It could be a march for a monarch's arrival, celebrated by everybody, willingly or unwillingly. It could be a victorious army returning home. Maybe a new ruler installed over a foreign land.
certainly it is triumphant. Now this is one hymn out of many. It stands unfortunately for many like Onward Christian Soldiers. It is also one hymn only in one category that I have real problems with when I was an organist. I tried always to refuse to play it. There is another whole group of songs, devotional, where Jesus is portrayed as sweet, fair, of course blonde, a little bit gooey. This is a whole other thing. Or we have the devotional hymns in our hymn book that praise nature. But do we have that relationship in our days, in our work days, in our work week? What I want to say with this is, that is the place where we are in our churches, as I experience them, unfortunately, everywhere where I go. Now, where are we? Or let us first ask, where is music now in the missionized region that is much bigger than the missionizing region? What music do people make now in the countries that have been missionized by us as Westerners? Let us sing together the what you have on your sheet, Sib Amandlan Khosi. It comes from South Africa. I will read the text for you in the rhythm that we will sing it. Sib Amandlan Khosi. And you repeat, please. Sib Amandlan Khosi. Vokunge Sabi. Vokunge Sabi. Sib Amandlan Khosi. Sib Amandlan Khosi. Siyava Dinga.
Siyava Dinga.
Sip amandlan kosi, wokunge sabi, sip amandlan kosi, siyava dinga. Let's do it together. Sip amandlan kosi, wokunge sabi, sip amandlan kosi, siyava dinga, sip amandlan. Yes. Thank you. I just wanted to show you. Yeah. We have to immediately go back because in Africa you sing this maybe 30 times, maybe 20, only 27 times, but usually more. So let's do this several times over that you get the feeling that first of all you get used to it and then you get the feeling what that means in your relationship to maybe your surroundings here.
Sip amandlan kosi, wokunge sabi, sip amandlan kosi, siyava dinga, sip amandlan kosi, wokunge sabi, sip amandlan kosi, siyava dinga.
Wonderful. Now, Africans stand up to that, to this and move to this. Unfortunately, I feel home. Something is not functioning. So let's improvise, stand up. If you want, clap with it. And I want you just to sing each verse once. As you see, we have, O God, give us power. Verse 2 is, O God, give us courage. Verse 3 is, O God, give us power again. Oh, and the last verse is Sip Amandla.
O God, give us power to recover. O God, give us power to lift our peace.
This melody has no composer. Nobody knows where it was first sung. It is nothing really special, is it? It's not as impressive as the other one. It is just something one can very easily pick up, hum at the workplace maybe, maybe even in the family, if the TV is out. You can take it and just have it in your system. The text is very different from our first example. It speaks about the everyday life of the people, their struggle against apartheid, their struggle against dehumanization, being excluded, being the disadvantaged, which means everything that ends with ism. Being disadvantaged is sexism. Being disadvantaged is being black or being of the other color. Classism. All those words I heard a South African colored say, we are the disadvantaged. But if you look at the text closely again, you will discern that it is not so specific to the South African system and feeling that it hasn't a message for us today in Minneapolis and tomorrow in other places. It is global enough that we as feminists or close to feminism could say it could be our song. What a blessing. Electronics. I think even that Jesus could have used this song. Maybe the women around him, they dared challenge Jesus on certain issues that they thought he should learn, and he did. It's a song that comes out of very strong faith, out of a community effort, and out of the knowledge of being weak. It addresses God as the God who is with and for the powerless, the poor, and in this case, the imprisoned. So the orientation of this song is very horizontal, really. It addresses issues of their life. On the other hand, it is the vertical, I think, is not missing, because it addresses them to God. Oh God, give us power. Not for us to be good, but for being a community of healed people. This is very, very central to the African feeling of life, as you heard this morning Mercy say. Identity dwells and is only experienced for African people in the traditional society as a member of a community where the member knows exactly the place. This has very strong positive effect on identity. It also, from our Western point of view, does not give the person the possibility to question the institution of the community, nor does it give the person the freedom to express herself or himself creatively. We should have this in mind. Let us also sing the next one. It comes from Asia, where there is a very long tradition of Buddhism and Hinduism in Java, on the island of Java. And this melody I chose here is adapted from either of the two. I am not aware which one. I will sing it for you. You might just join because you are so good in reading music.
Amen, hallelujah. Amen, hallelujah.
again. It has to connect again where we started out with you. Try to sing it into yourself. And only the leftover that doesn't fit into your body anymore will come out.
Amen, hallelujah. Amen, hallelujah. We praise your name, O God. Amen, hallelujah.
Hallelujah. Yes. We have 10 minutes.
Yes. Yeah.
We have silence, and we need it. We have to go back to ourselves. Because now I want you to search for the image of God within you. And I want you to find a text that we could agree on, or we could take as a gift.
This is the end of side one. Fast forward the tape to cue it up for your continued listening.
So have a moment, think of one important experience or sentence that we can adopt as a community. Maybe you write it down, or maybe you are courageous enough to say it aloud, so we can use it for making our song now. Is there anybody who dares stand up and proclaim a sentence? Yes?
God with us.
God with us.
Blessed are you among women, and blessed is the fruit of your womb.
I have come that you may have life and have it to the fullest.
Sorry, I cannot write that fast. We have to decide on one, right? So blessed... could you help writing? Can I just leave it at blessed are you among women rather than the second sentence, because that would make a long melody for us. It would complicate our task. I had another suggestion from back there. You write it, okay? One more? And?
Do you have what you need? Bring forth what is within you, and it will save you.
I'm really looking for very specific to our situation here now. Did somebody say God is within you and within me? No. I will, this is not a selection of the best, but selection of maybe what is possible to sing to. Do you agree on blessed are you among women? Now, who do we speak to? Is this, do we think of Mary or do we think of each other? Are we sure of that? Can we use this? Okay, now, I say it again. Listen to the rhythm of this sentence. Blessed are you among women. Blessed are you among women. Is there a melody in the room?
Blessed are you.
We have done something I have never done before. And you not either, I suppose. Let us keep this melody. We might offer it in our worship service tomorrow.
Blessed are you among women. Blessed are you.
Something to it. If we sit as we do at the moment, I feel, whom do we really address that? And that was this question is not answered yet. Can we do something in movement that would enhance whom we, or make clear whom we mean by blessed are you? Would you remain where you are and we sing and you do it, please? And then whoever feels can have a partner. Let's try to do if this works out, yeah?
Blessed are you among women. Blessed are you. Blessed are you among women. Blessed are you among women.
My wish for you, for us all, is that we can have the courage you showed today in your congregations and try to do something where the professional theologians as well as the professional musicians will be encouraged to let us do what they have been trained for. Because I think as we do theology here, we also should dare to do music together on an unprescribed level that comes out of the experience that we have and where we identify. Thank you very much.
I wonder if you have any idea how beautiful you all looked singing that song and doing that movement. Maybe it's sleep deprivation, but it's really neat. Thank you to our three artists who are all blessed among women today. We have a few minutes for questions. If you have other cards, we'll pick them up now. What did I say?
Well, just that there's this whole pile of cards and we have 2 minutes.
Well, we have 15 minutes, right? So we'll whip along here. And I think the way this will work is I will read a question, and if it's addressed to a specific person, we'll ask them, and then if others want to respond, they can chime in. And I think I would ask the three of you to use these small microphones on the table so we get it all on tape. I have here a request to show two of Nalini's paintings, which I think would be very helpful. We didn't get to see her work. Would you like to do that now?
I am an Asian theologian, and I am so glad that I met Nalini. So I bought two of her paintings, and I just want to share with you, brothers and sisters. This one is entitled Compassion.
I think if you hold it on the paper.
And this one is entitled Nativity.
Very nice.
Nativity.
That's the search you talked about.
Here we have a question for any one of the three of you who'd like to chime in. How do you get from the story or idea to the image? What's your process? In 5 seconds.
Scribbling. I'm serious. You watched Wynne and I, who have never painted together. We didn't really even know how each other painted. We started with a scribble. You saw it work. And you're seeing it unfold. That's exactly how I work. Only I listen to what people are saying, and I scribble while they're talking.
Okay. This is for Ingelina. How can we facilitate authentic music when we're among cultures who've had their original ways repressed? This person will be working in Panama.
What was the second part?
How can we facilitate authentic music when we're among cultures who have had their original ways repressed? I think your word for it was missionized. Or
is that it? Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's amazing. Functioning and not functioning, but somehow it goes. It's a difficult question. I think authentic music in where I have been in the world does not exist in churches at the moment. It's excavated, which means 100 to 400 years of colonization and missionizing have to be scraped away if there is memory to that far away past. We have to be aware that most music in the world has never been written down. What we sing here is written down, but of course for local people that would make such a narrow way of dealing with that music, because now they cannot improvise anymore and add a syllable or subtract a syllable. And they can't change a little bit here and a little bit there. I think what we have to encourage is local people to first get their theology straight, because I strongly believe that you cannot have poetry, new poetry, church poetry, nor church music where the theology has not been enculturated. That means soiled where the soil is. Christianity, as I said yesterday, is still a potted plant in most missionized countries. So what we have to do is try to dig below the influence of the westernized Christianity that was brought by our forebears, and then encourage creativity where there was suppression, and then see what comes out. I think more we cannot, we can just encourage. Is that the answer that the person was looking for? It helps.
Okay. For Nancy, what are your thoughts on ways to make bridges from traditional images in worship spaces, for example, White Mary statues, to new visual images?
May I look at the question?
I think that's
it's much easier.
I think, first of all, the first thing that comes to me is that the bridge needs to be temporary. And what I mean by that is, part of the problem with visual art is that it becomes fixed in our images and therefore limits our imagination. So could the White Mary statue disappear for a particular festival or a particular period of time, with the congregation understanding that she will come back? You know, she will come back, but we're going to look at something else for a while. The other thing that comes to me, and this is a very complex question, so this is a very surface answer. The other thing that comes to me is the importance of not one person deciding that, but that a community needs to discern that, and the community needs to advocate it, so that the artist who presents the work is not left alone to defend it. I think those are the first two things that come on the top of my head. I really believe in committee work. I really believe in community discernment when it's truthful.
Okay. Nancy, there are several questions here all along the same line, which are, how do you hang these large-scale projects?
That is just a fabulous question. I work in three different ways. Drop line systems, which means a simple hook up in the ceiling and a line that goes through it that gets fastened to the wall that you can stand on the floor and essentially go fishing with it. That's the easiest way. I don't do ladders too much anymore. I'm too heavy and too old. My favorite way is in Grace Cathedral. They have this great internal catwalk system, and I stand on the floor with my walkie-talkie and I say, a little to the left. If your church has needed one of those things, and sometimes that system has to go through the ceiling. You can't get it hooked onto the architecture itself. The third way, well, there's two other ways that are a little bit more outrageous. The first one is that, you know, part of what I like to do art in the church is that it just involves so many people and so many different people's talents. And one of the talents that we can call on is to not go to be fishers of men, but to call all the fly fishermen in to, you know, give us a line through that place up there. And the most outrageous one that I've done, that I think is really a lot of fun, actually was invented by a man in my church when we went into this space where we were going to have Easter Vigil and the church had taken down our drop line system. And he said, in his inventive and creative way, well, let's use helium balloons to hang the angels. And I went, what? You know, for Easter Vigil? How? But I went home and I thought about it and he was right. And we used huge helium balloons. And what was wonderful about it was that the angels visited.
Thank you.
And whoever asked that question, if you would like drawings or anything like that afterwards, come on up and we'll talk about it.
Okay, for Nalini and Nancy, discuss right brain and left brain relationships in the church.
Oh. I don't know if you can say anything about that.
Sure, I can. You know, there's a whole system of theology that's been held, and Nalini, you've taught at Yale, I've taught at PSR. The academic climate of a seminary is ferocious. It is a left brain climate. And the imagination from which, let's face it, prayer comes is not nurtured. And until we can face that split in us, we're never going to deal with the arts seriously. I mean, look what, this is awful to say, but look what happened Thursday night. We went for the academics and not for the art. And they were both important. We needed to find a way to do both. So they're friends, but right now the way the system's set up, we don't acknowledge the right brain, the side of us that imagines, the side of us that dreams, the side of us that has vision, the side of us that loves, that cares, that has passion. You know, that's one of my soapboxes. I better stop. Yeah.
Nalini.
You just talk into it.
Yes, fortunately for me, I've spent nearly 7 years at Yale, and I didn't in all those years see that there were two sides to this brain at all. I suppose it was because of the influence of the religion and arts program, which is has grown and has nurtured and nourished and influenced people from every other department as well. I mean, they would come up the hill to hear John Cook's lectures, to hear Peter Hawkins, to hear some of Granger Ryan, some of these exceptional, extraordinary people. As for this division that exists, certainly does, it's regrettable that people don't really realize what power the arts have in influencing and directing not only the minds and hearts of people, but also their lives.
I'd like to put a precautionary notice in here, and that is where I'm frightened about the arts and churches, that often we are tools of propaganda, or we're graffiti specialists. You know, I get so tired of words that are calligraphed, and that's supposed to be visual art. Visual art's so much more than that. And yet, if there's not a word in it, it's somehow not religious.
Take that. For any of you that would like to respond to this, but this is addressed particularly to Nancy, do you have hints for those of us trying to do large group projects with people unfamiliar with the medium? How do you maintain a creative, supportive ambiance amidst the inevitable tensions and problems?
Can I see the question? Do you want to talk about that?
You want to say something?
You say something. I think the first thing is keep it simple. Keep it simple and try it out. And allow yourself to fail. And give yourself forgiveness for not getting it perfect.
I support what Nancy said and would add that if we tell a group like this in the very beginning that it is in a way dangerous, maybe dangerous for some, to face suddenly, to face a picture or today a sentence or a piece of music that overwhelms them suddenly, I think if we make it, everybody aware that might happen, but it's okay. We are together, we can help each other, or it is good, it comes out. Then I think we have done put all the safe guards in and hope for the best.
Thank you. We have one more question, unless there are others out there. I think our time is about up. I think, Nancy, it's my understanding that your works are designed to be used and some of them are temporary installments. Am I right about that?
That's correct. First of all, I live in a really small space, and what do I do with all of it?
Well, and I think that's what this question is getting at. I'll pass it to you. What is the significance of that for you?
The significance of it for me, I tried to talk about in my lecture, and that is, you know, if you make a great banner for the church and put it up 10 years in a row, there's no room for newness. And I want the Word of God to come to, I'm very demanding, I demand that the Word of God come to me freshly. And if I have to use old forms year after year after year, and I only have to take care of them all the time, but they can't say something new to me time and time and time again, and I don't get to hear the new voice. I use my work, and like the banners in there, I love seeing them flow through the church. There have been many people that have come up already to say, how can we borrow them? You borrow anything I make by simply paying to have it packed up, shipped to you, and ship it back to me. I think Lewis Hyde has been my mentor in this. He says that nothing is worth anything unless it's given away. I really believe that. I believe that God has given me a great gift, and my task is to pass it on. And along the way, I get great gifts, and that's how I keep my economic self afloat. And that's just that simple. I'm not attached to the objects. I can make new ones.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you all for being here.
This is the end of Side 2. Fast forward the tape to cue it up for your next listening.